Thou
The living room's dark, save for light being cast from the big TV screen and the imminent sunrise that's teasing the one starry sky with whispers of morning.
What is a co-host? A miserable little pile of secrets, but enough talk. How are you?
I am well, Diavad. How are you?
I'm not going to try and do yours backwards. It feels like there's either a curse word in there or it'll summon some sort of demon.
I think like if we were to do mine, like truly it would be egg, you know, but like,
yeah. Cause how does it change the vowel pronunciation? Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's why when, you know, like it's like Alucard, I was like, it's Dracula backwards. That was kind of convenient though, that works out to being a cool name. Like Alucard is an awesome name, you know, like if it was just like, you know, Egg, I'd be like, what the? Oh, it's George backwards. That's, come on, guys. Just work a little bit harder.
Yeah. I mean, you have to believe they like focus group tested that, or they were like, you know, oh, the main character is Alucard. And someone in the room was like, oh, that's an interesting name. And it's like, oh, he's from the same part of the world as Dracula. And then, like, eventually one guy in the room puts it together and is like,
wait a minute. I feel like that, you know, they were kind of a, let's see how far we can, like how long we can get away with this. And then, you know, like they're sitting there like, oh, well then Alucard this and Alucard that. And then like, they're all kind of sitting around the table and you see one person's eyes like go wide and he just gets like tackled out of the room. You know?
Don't spoil it. It's going to be a huge reveal.
But anyways, so yeah, what are your nostalgia experience for this?
We have to be quite clear. This is not just any Castlevania. This is Castlevania Symphony of the Night, right? Because there's a lot of Alucards floating around in the Netflix sphere right now. But the game we specifically played, Castlevania Symphony of the Night, which I think is the sixth in the series. It's out there. It's not the second one.
All I know is it's after Rondo of Blood. Like that's my little trivia.
True story. Yes.
Yes.
I was writing so this game came out in March of 1997, and I have to assume that by Christmas of 1997, everyone at Konami was like, thank God we did not do a fall release. Because if they'd done a fall release of this game, it would have gone up against Final Fantasy VII.
Woof.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. And it would have been lost to history.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
that is no bueno.
My nostalgia goggles for this game are, I think I may have accidentally stolen this because I know that I didn't own this game. I was definitely borrowing it from my friend, but I remember having it in my possession so much as a kid that I think I may have just never given it back to him. So... I played it a lot is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's one of those things where like there's a fine line. I saw a thing online at one point where somebody said, at what point does it stop being grave robbing and start being archaeology? And like and the response was, as an archaeologist, this deeply disturbs me. You know? And it's kind of like that where it's like, at what point does it stop being borrowing and starts being stealing? And I think it's when the borrowee, so the person who's lending, the lender, either tacitly or overtly requires the substance back and does not have access to it, then you have stolen it.
Yeah, and I presume because as an adult I had to rebuy this game that I must have returned it to him at some point. I just remember having it in my possession and anytime access to it for functionally this entire portion of my life. So yeah, that's a very specific nostalgia experience, which is like, I played it a lot and paid nothing.
So for me, my nostalgia experience for this, I mean, full disclosure, it's nothing. Like I did not play this before now, but my nostalgia experience for this is watching the Castlevania Netflix series, which is amazing, and everyone should stop what they're doing, abandon their family and their responsibilities and go watch it. It's really good. But the reason why I think it kind of counts as a nostalgic experience for this game is because clearly I've played a couple of different Castlevanias, and from my seat, the show is at least most heavily influenced by this game, because there's a little subsection that I don't know when we want to fit it in, where I've got like a rapid fire of like three things that I've got to talk about, like references from the show that they captured really elegantly, because I've never, because when I saw that Castlevania was a Netflix series, I was like, well, you can't make a good video game TV show. Like it has never been done. Like, you know, even though it's been done, I think a small handful of times, but anytime when that happens, I raise a huge eyebrow to it, because, you know, immediately I start having Vietnam flashbacks to like Mario Brothers and, you know, things like that.
It's not the common case that quality is involved.
Yeah, exactly. Most of the time it's shovelware. It's the same way when somebody says, you know, oh yeah, this is a video game based on a movie. You're like, well, it's probably hot garbage, which is why when we got 3/4 of the way through the GoldenEye episode, it's like, yeah, you know, this is based off of a movie, right? It's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
So anyways, but the thing I think is interesting is that they basically, the TV show is a very loving homage to the video game. It is not, they're not just saying like, hey, we got a video game, let's rip as much wholesale stuff as we can and make it into a show. They more so made it into a show, and then they took a small pinch of the video game and then like just did that kind of meme sprinkle into the actual show of like fun little references that you would only get if you played the game. So by virtue of playing the game, now that I have, I was actually seeing some of the references that they made in the game. I'm like, oh, that's classy. It's a classy union of two things. So I wanted to talk about that instead of my nostalgia experience.
If I was a better podcaster, I would say like, oh, let's save that for the end of the episode. So then, you know, it'll tease it for people. But, you know, we have a structure to this. And in lieu of your nostalgia experience, like, I'm curious, like what were these things that you, and I'll say just to make sure, you know, the show happens before the events of the game. So it's the same Alucard, obviously, right? He's functionally immortal. He's a vampire, but, the show chronologically is first, even though in release, you would say the game came first.
Right. So a couple of things is, and like, there's obviously, you know, like the obvious references, like Alucard is in it, you know, like Dracula. I mean, you know, so there's the castle, which looks very similar. But you know, outside of all of that, the ones that I was kind of happy that, that I was able to pick up on is, so when you save the game, there is a massive D20, right? right.
Yeah.
That's what Dracula uses to move the castle.
Oh my God.
Yeah, right? And it's just like,
you're so right.
Yeah, it's just like one of those things that is just so central to the game. And again, they didn't like, it's like, well, like, it's a save point, so how could we, like, there is no saving in the universe, obviously, but they're like, let's pull that imagery over. So it's just very clearly one-to-one. It spins the same way, you know, it opens up the same way when he uses it to move the castle, you know? So it's just, it's very clearly a reference to that, but again, just done in a very classy way. So, and this is probably a little bit of a stretch, but you have different familiars in the game, right? You can have a sword familiar, which is a basically disembodied sword that floats around all the time. Mm. I believe that that's where Alucard got his sword kinesis from in the show, you know?
Yeah, no, because in the show, it's supposed to be that, like, the sword is magical and he is the wielder of it. In the game, mm-hmm. it's mechanically, it's a separate thing from your equipped weapon, whereas in the show it kind of is his equipped weapon, but like, I would say there's a good chance that's supposed to be the same thing.
Right. And that's the thing, is that that's kind of what I feel is so impressive about the way the show handles the video game references, is because it's like, they're like, well, if we did a direct one-to-one, it would be hammy and it wouldn't really fit the universe. But they're like, okay, well, what is it? It is a sword that acts on its own. Like, well, can we make that pretty cool? And the answer is yes. Yes, they can. The one other place where it really, I felt, did a great homage was at the beginning of season three, they're kind of going through this backwooded area and they come across a bunch of night creatures, right? And one of the night creatures flies and it picks up the first night creature and, you know, like they form like a two-person duo. That's the first boss in the game, just straight up. You know, and they don't make it into some huge thing where they're like, this is the most powerful night creature. They're like, nah, man, we're just going to make like a little thing where if you played the game, you will recognize this pairing. And that's it. And the thing is that the reason why I believe all of these homages are done well is because at no point when I was watching the show the first time, they say like, oh, that's a video game thing. Oh, that's a video game thing. Like, it just all made perfect sense in universe. And then when I played the video game, I'm like, oh, this is where they got the inspiration for that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think the thing Dracula uses to move the castle is the best example of like a Lair's joke, right? You will appreciate the reference if you get it, but because it's a magical control stick for a magical moving castle, it's, you're not like, why is it shaped like that? It's like, because it's
right.
Because why is anything anything? He's a vampire.
Yeah.
So that's like, yeah, a great place to insert a little reference like that, because there is no real life equivalent. I mean, what were they going to give him, a Super Nintendo controller? Like, it needed to be something magical, like some kind of magical interaction with the magical castle. So that's a great little place to just be like, oh, it's going to be, yeah, like a little spinny thing, and it's going to look like the save spot from Symphony of the Night, because why the hell not?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, exactly. So those were, in lieu of my nostalgia experience, those were some of the ones that that I was able to pick up. I'm sure there's way more, but as I was playing through, I was like, huh, neat.
So there's one that happens in the other direction that I'm aware of, which is so the Belmont, since the show canonically would come earlier than the game, the Belmont, mm-hmm, in this is Trevor Belmont, right? Mm-hmm. And sometime between the show and the game, several hundred years managed to pass. And so, mm-hmm, Alucard goes into like, I'm sad about being the child of Dracula sleep, basically. Spoilers, mm-hmm, he's the child of Dracula. And then when he like emerges, that's when the series of events of Symphony of the Night take place. We'll get to the game eventually, I'm sure. But
sure.
In the beginning of the game, when you encounter Maria and she's looking for Richter, mm-hmm, she's like, oh, I'm looking for this guy. And he's like, oh, who? And she's like, oh, it's a Belmont. And she has a little thought bubble of Richter because she knows who she's looking for. And Alucard goes, a Belmont? And his little thought bubble is of Trevor, because that is the Belmont that was alive when Alucard was last awake. And I was just like,
interesting.
I was like, oh, that's awesome. Because if you know the Castlevania games really well, you know what, now you have an idea for how far apart in time each of the games are, because this happened, you know, hundreds of years ago. I think it's like 300 years ago, but it's in the game universe. The joke is that the sprite he imagines is an 8-bit Nintendo sprite, and the sprite she imagines is a, you know, like a 32-bit, you know, PS1 sprite. So it's like, because the show now exists, that joke is now better because it went on to retroactively reference this other thing. Like, it's, I love that kind of like Disney Pixar shared universe. Like, look, it's the ball with the star. Like, I appreciate that kind of stuff so much.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, it's really good. But you want to go to, you know, notes, Patreon. Oh, because that's the thing. Oh, yeah. So, you know, comments, suggestions, be a part of our community. But if you wanted to do an extra mile, any places that we, the, any references that we have missed between the show and the video game, you know, leave it in like the notes and comments and all that good stuff.
Oh yeah. And don't be lazy. Don't just link to somebody else's Wikipedia article of all the stuff they noticed, you know, come with your own observations, which we will appreciate and value very much, but you know, do the work of observing.
Yeah, well, I think that our no research rule holds to the notes in the comments as well, right? Like, we have a strong aura of no research.
It's just, I mean, it's, are we like dark paladins? Where like, instead of giving buffs to the people around us, we give them like debuffs?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, but in a way, aggressive ignorance is its own buff, you know?
Yeah. I will say, you know, so do recommend the show, leave reviews. I'm really enjoying the people who have been joining in on Twitch, because you get a certain kind of person, and I am one of these people, so I'm not speaking negatively about these people, but you get a certain kind of person who doesn't just like to play video games or talk about video games, but they like to watch other people play video games. And someone came into the chat the last day that I was playing this on stream and basically like percentage shamed me for the entire time he was in the chat. So like,
I knew
this was going to be my last play session. There are a few people in there talking, so I'm like having just kind of a relaxed time. Cause I was like, when I am bored, I'm going to go kill Dracula and then I'll be done with this playthrough. And I was like, okay, I can see there's like a little area over there and I don't feel like walking all the way over there. And I know there's this other thing and I'm not going to go get that, but you know, total's like 212% and I've got to be over 200%. And this one guy in the chat was just like, there's no way, you're definitely under 200. And I was like, no, I'm pretty sure. And he was like, no, because this particular area, the remaining like 11% is on the other side of that area and you haven't gone there. There's no way. And I was like, all right. The only place I know of to check your percentage is on the load screen. So I was like, I'm literally going to restart the console just so I can load my game to see where it was. And it was 196.8%. I was like, well, screw you. I'm still going to go kill Dracula. And he was a good sport about it. He supported me all the way through. But I was just like, damn it. Like, this guy really, really knows the game. If he can just drop in at the
off the cuff.
Yeah, at the 11th hour and 59th minute and just be like, there's no way you're over 200%, and be absolutely correct.
Yeah, no, basically it was the Twitch stream viewer equivalent of where you're like, oh man, I thought I was over 200%. I'm sorry. Don't be sorry. Be better.
it was because it was tough love. Like he wanted me to go the last mile and get up to 212, but it was late. I was tired. Maybe next game.
So visuals.
I played a lot more PS1 than you, and some of my favorite memories of the PS1 I've realized are tied up in the fact that the PS1 was not afraid to do high res pixel art. And this game has some 3D and it has some like wooshy wooshy particle effects, but a whole lot of this game is just beautiful high res pixel art. And I appreciate that so much, like so much. It's just, this game is just gorgeous. Like, and pixel art to me ages a lot better than low poly, right? Personally. And so like going back and seeing it is great. And I've shared this game with people over the years and they don't have a nostalgia experience for it. And when they go back and look at it, they're like, oh, this game looks really good. And I'm like, yeah, it does. It does look really good.
Well, because the thing is that your brain immediately, like, you know, your brain doesn't spend a whole lot of time like with gradations like this. You know, what your brain is really, really good at doing is putting things into buckets. You know, that's one of the reasons why we have so many logical fallacies that we have about bucketing things incorrectly. But basically, when your brain thinks pixel art, it thinks SNES era, you know, SNES Genesis, right? And the PlayStation computationally blows those systems out of the water, you know? So the thing is that your brain is saying like, oh my God, this looks really, really good. It's because you're comparing it to Super Mario World, you know, which again, this game could run circles around, you know, and it does. And the thing is that it uses all of that additional bandwidth, I think very, very well, in the sense that, so they said like, okay, you know what, we're going to create a 2D pixel art game. It's like, okay, well, that's taking 10% of our resources as opposed to 80% like it would with SNES. So it's like, well, what do we do with the rest of it? It's like, okay, you know what we're going to do? We're going to make a billion enemies, a bajillion million enemies. You look at how many enemies there are. There's so many enemies, right? So they spent all of their additional resources creating a world of scope and grandeur that could not have been dreamt of in earlier systems, which is absolutely the way to do it. You know? So I think that, yeah, it absolutely ages really, really well because It's not in the weird, what we are staring at is like a very, very majestic, sleek, you know, spearfish, right? We're not, we're not looking at, you know, either a, the majestic ape or the majestic fish. We're not looking at the weird fish that grew legs and kind of could walk on land, which is what you get when you look at low res poly, you know, it's, you're seeing like that weird, that weird, oh, or it's like you're seeing a cute baby or a full grown chiseled adult, not weird, awkward teenager, you know?
That's, yeah, that I do like fish with legs, but awkward teenager is another great way to think about it, because so many early 3D games were awkward teenagers as far as gaming, you know, history goes, and high res pixel art is the glow up that all Super Nintendo era games dreamed of having. And I have literally the next thing in my notes is, oh my God, so much variety, because we have waxed and waned over our, you know, review career about what we think of palette swapping, when it's okay, when it's not, when you are surprised that you didn't even notice, right? And other times when it's like damn near game breaking. And this game has a little bit of palette swapping, like a very, very tiny, tiny, tiny little bit. But there's like a bajillion enemies. And I think I'm only very slightly exaggerating. But then on top of it, there's a bajillion unique environments. And then on top of that, almost not every single weapon, but almost every single weapon has a unique look to it when you swing it, right? It either has like a slightly different particle effect or a slightly different color, or it's the sword's a little bigger, or it's a little smaller, or it's
all the cloaks as well.
Yeah, all the cloaks. And one of the cloaks even lets you choose colors. So if they don't, if they didn't put in colors that you like, there's one cloak you can buy or find, maybe find it, but then like you can go into the menu and choose colors, which is in itself a clever reference to other RPGs, because like Final Fantasy, Secret of Mana, Chrono Trigger, like those games let you change the color on the text box, and it uses the exact same interface to let you change the color on the cloak. Like there's just, there
the
is
the color of the cloak changes the color that you are when you're a bat, you know?
Yes. Yes, there's just visual. Speaking of the bat, it always really annoyed me that when you turn
Never
into
have
the
you sounded more like a Batman villain than right then.
You're probably right. When you turn into the wolf, it always bugged me the way the sword looks like it's sort of like sticking on his collar, and it's like, oh, his sword doesn't transform. It's like on him. And, the bat also has the sword on it, but it blends in so well that I literally never noticed before this playthrough. Right. And this isn't a graphical quality thing. This is just my opinion, but like they really spent not just the processing power of the PlayStation on the visual, but a lot of love and care and detail went into every enemy, every enemy's animation, all of Alucard's animations, the backgrounds, the environments, the spells, the shields, the like there's just so much. The art budget for this game must have been bonkers.
Well, and that's the thing is that, you know, like I think that this is kind of where we were seeing, you know, again, it's a really fascinating type of game for this time in video game history, because what we were starting to see, and I am not an industry expert, so take everything I say with a grain of salt, but you know, is this is when, you know, when you're starting to create 3D games and stuff like that, you need way more teams doing way more artists, assets and all that sort of stuff. So if they basically said, we are going to take a PS1 game budget, because this is a PS1 game, right? But it's all going to be 2D. Well, then instead of spending so much time creating all these different textures and like arranging all of these 3D poly lines, you know, to make sure that everything looks semi-reasonable, it's like, okay, well, to create one car in Twisted Metal takes like, you know, 500 hours. Well, in 500 hours, you can make a whole bunch of different pixel art designs, you know, and it's all money in the end, right?
Well, and there's a resource sync that I don't remember who, I wish I could say this was an original idea, but some other game developer gave me this idea. A game developer. I'm not a game developer. I just talk about other people's hard work. But
and judge them.
Yes, literally for hours at a time every other week. But something that this time in history was a victim of that later parts of history were not, which is if you were a pixel artist around this era, you had experience making pixel art. You did not have experience making 3D art, or certainly not as much. So not only could you say, oh, well, we're going to pay for, you know, 1,000 hours of art design, but that person was able to way more hit the ground running with tools that they were comfortable. So this is more like going to a painter and saying, instead of saying like, oh, hey, can you craft Mario out of marble? And it's like, well, I mean, I guess like if you pay for the tools, I guess I could chisel a statue out. And instead going to a painter and saying, what if you had unlimited paint and unlimited canvases, then what could you do? And then they're like, oh, like, let me get in there and make 1 billion unique enemies and 1 billion unique backgrounds and animate clever little details and stuff in the backgrounds, right? Because there's no like skill barrier. It's just they suddenly have resources to play, you know, and that's yeah. Like, this is what you get when you can do that, is you get a game that looks like this.
And I think that, you know, as you said, that this game does have some 3D elements to it, but I think that those are, again, in my opinion, leveraged very, very well. Like one of the biggest places that I can think of off the top of my head is obviously the D20 slash coffin save animation, right? That's predominantly 3D, but it's not like, you know, like the way that they animated the D20 and all that sort of stuff, is it looks eerie, and the entire room is eerie. When you walk in, it pulsates like a beating heart, you know? So the fact that the 3D is a little out of place kind of fits the theme that they kind of went with there, which is that it is a different area. It immediately grabs your eye and grabs your attention. Pretty much anytime when they use true 3D, like with fire and things like that, you know, it's very eye grabbing. The one place where they use 3D where I was like, I wasn't feeling it, was with the books in the library.
Yeah, like, agreed.
Yeah, I was just kind of like, I was like, I don't know, either don't do the books or don't do them that way. That was just a little odd. If that was not in there, I almost would not have noticed the 3D effects, you know? So I thought that was very, very skillfully done, merging those two things together.
One place they used the power of a rendering engine like they had on the PlayStation, that this is a thing, it's just another one of those opinion things. I just don't like the way this looks, and so I notice it whenever I see it, is some of the very large enemies, like a couple of the really big bosses, I think a few regular enemies maybe, but definitely this happens with a few bosses. They are very large and they move in a very particular, like angular sort of rounded way where they arch awkwardly, and hand animating each of those cells in pixel art would be a big pain in the ass. So they didn't. They took a static image and they chopped it up into pieces and then morph it and stretch it and bend it in ways that pixels can't do, right? You can't have a pixel that goes at a diagonal angle. You have to fake it with squares. And so when you see, and a lot of modern games that use pixel art do this, where there's a static sprite and then they cut it into pieces and they animate the pieces. And sometimes it looks great. Most of the time, I think it looks weird just because my brain is very tuned to how pixel art moves, and that is not how it moves. And it can look great, but because there's only a handful of places in the game that do that, like the books, they sort of stand out as like, oh, they didn't want to hand animate this boss because it would have been a giant pain in the ass. So they did it this like new and modern way that you couldn't do on like the Super Nintendo, but they could now do computationally on the PlayStation. So it's not, you know, not the end of the world, but it's just one of those things that it makes you notice the graphics, and you're not saying like, oh my God, the world is beautiful, or oh, that enemy is terrifying. You go, oh, those graphics look weird, right? Which is that stepping back from the experience, because there's so much in the world that you comment on as if it's real, right? Like, oh, look, there's a ghoul in the cell in the background. I wonder if they're ever going to pop out. They never pop out. But, you know, like that, like, ooh, or this, like, oh, this spell looks so cool, and like, I feel powerful when I use this magic or whatever. But those are all like in-universe feelings, where you're having feelings about the universe, to notice like, oh, that guy bent awkwardly. Squares don't bend like that, right? That's having a feeling about the game. And it's not game-breaking. It's nowhere close to even being more than just like a little splinter or a paper cut. But on this playthrough, since I was, you know, taking notes about the graphics, I was very aware of that.
So one big thing I want to make sure that we touch on is the hitbox. So the hitbox is super in your favor. Like, there is a definitely a number of times when I was like, oh God, that should have hit me, but it didn't. So yay. So especially towards the beginning, I really appreciated that as you're kind of like learning the game and learning the mechanics and kind of how you move and interact with the universe. Because, so this trades into mechanics a little bit, but, with my first experience, I'm used to modern games like anyone else. I'm used to them saving on their own from time to time, right? So I jumped right into the game and I died because at the beginning you don't have a lot of hit points and death steals all your equipment, like the giant tool that death is, you know. And I died, and then it brought me back to like the beginning, like I was Richter at the beginning, you know. Yeah, because I didn't save at all, you know. And so the nice thing though is that really instilled the fear in me. So, you know, when I was like desperately looking for a save point to save the last hour that I had like done, I appreciated the fact that I never got tagged in a way that I was like, that's unfair. The thing that, so that's good. We've seen games do that. We've seen games not. What this game has done that I think we've seen very few, if any, games in general do, almost certainly no pixel art games, is that there's two hitboxes. There's the enemy hitbox and then the enemy's weapon hitbox, right? Mm-hmm. And those are different because
they have a different effect.
Correct. And I think that that's awesome because if you're just jumping around and the enemy like checks you physically, it does like 1/10 as much damage than if the weapon hits you. If their attack hits you, then you take substantial damage, which mechanically I think is, it makes sense because there's plenty of times when I was jumping around and the thing I was fighting moved erratically or in a way I wasn't anticipating, or when I tagged them, this one got knocked into the air, whereas some of them don't, you know, and like, so I would run into them somehow and I'd take like 3 hit points, 1 hit point of damage, and be like, oh, okay, well, that was a mild mistake. But when you hit their actual weapon, you have really screwed up. They telegraph their techniques pretty hard, you know, so it's like, no, I deserved taking 15, 25 damage. I'm playing stupidly or too aggressively or something like that, you know? So the fact that those are two different hitboxes, I thought was actually very, very well done.
Well, and this is something that you would notice, like if you took a really beautiful Super Nintendo game, because Lord knows there's plenty of them, right? And a game like Symphony of the Night, and you gave them to a player without telling them like what system it was for or like what time in history it's from, someone really closely observing the mechanics, and this is visual specifically, but like someone really closely observing the mechanics might be able to tell which game came earlier, because computing all of those different hitboxes on screen at the same time is computationally more intensive than they could reasonably get away with on something like Super Nintendo, especially as you were trying to dial up your visual and audio fidelity. Those are processor resources that you now can't use to do other things like compute complicated hitboxes, right? Like famously in the original Super Mario Brothers, one of the ways to beat Bowser, if you're like a speedrunner, is when he is like throwing hammers, like as you see Bowser in later and later castles, he throws like more and more of the I guess they're hammers or little axes or whatever. Like,
they're hammers.
Yeah.
Because the other people that throw them are the Hammer Brothers.
Yeah. So
the Axe Brothers. That'd be a real garbage name. It's like, you're the Hammer Brothers. What do you throw? Axes?
Our name is Hammer. What are you confused about?
Yeah, I am Mr. Hammer, and This is my sister, Mrs. Hammer. Oh, what? You assumed we were both guys? This is terrible.
Yeah. Glass houses, Mario. Anyway. But like, so if you actually look at the number of hammers that are drawn on screen, there are more of them than they can do collision detection for on the original Nintendo. So you can just clip right through them if you know which ones don't have collision detection on them, and it's always the same ones, right? So it's like the first, say, like 5 of them have collision detection, and then the next 3 don't, because they couldn't do the math. Like, they couldn't make the processor do it. And that exact same kind of thing is happening here, where Alucard is, you know, not super big, and but he wears like a big cape over his pauldrons. And when he swings his sword, he sort of like turns sideways, and depending on the kind of the weapon, like it's a very fencery long, you know, kind of motion. And so there's a lot of empty space under the sword before you get to his body. The enemies are all sorts of weird shapes because they're demons and monsters and whatnot. So they're lots of them is, you know, empty space or between tentacles or whatever. And those things don't register a hit on you or on them because you didn't hit them, right? They can have their hitbox actually be made up of a billion little boxes that are layered over each other, and you end up with this crazy like Venn diagram. And that's something that is satisfying because it matches with what you're seeing, right? When you have a big clunky rectangular hitbox and there's collision, because, oh, well, it hit the rectangle, even though it didn't hit the sprite as the sprite is animated, that is not a good feeling, right? And here they can not only take away that feeling, but then also be as generous as they want to be with making you hit them, right? And they could do different math, right? The body is, you know, less damaged than the weapon is and stuff. And that's like, it's all invisible. Like, that's all happening behind the visuals, but it makes the visuals feel, I'm going to say, more accurate. Like it makes what you're seeing feel truer to what's happening in the game.
Right. It makes it feel more fair, more like a representation of what should be happening. I've got a whole, like, about four more just rapid fire. Like, we don't need a deep discussion. just quick notes that, because they're not meaty things, but they're kind of cool little interesting things. So do you have any other like meaty stuff you want to talk about?
The only other thing that I have that's really important to me is just to reemphasize not just the amount of variety, but the amount of detail. Like when Alucard,
I assume the amount of, like, you mean just with the game, right? Because otherwise, the only thing that I have that's really important to me is
this is all I have.
This is it. Take that, wife and kids. That's just like the way you just phrased it was like, the only thing I have that's really important to me is how this one visual really.
Oh no, that was actually a smudge on your TV. Well, off to kill myself. But I like the variety, I think, is important, but the detail is where the craftsmanship, because anybody can make a lot of crap, right? But the detail is where I think like the love for the universe really comes through from the artist. And so I have like a few of these. When your magic bar refills, you do like a little flash that it's the same color as the magic bar. So it's really clear like what's happening visually. When you start moving, you leave this little like totally needless after image that makes no sense and does nothing but looks super cool.
It does. And that's another reference to the show.
Yes, it totally is. The save icon on the memory card changes depending on either how far you are in the game or where you were when you saved. I can't remember. I think it might be where you were when you saved. Yeah, but every time you load from the memory card, there's a little unique icon that is only there and is nowhere else in the game. It's nowhere else in the universe, right? It's like just so many little delicious little details, just, and not even sprinkled throughout, just like this thick layer of love and care on all of the graphics.
Absolutely. No, couldn't agree more. And actually that leads nicely into my little noticing of beautiful little details that they put in. One is that the map mechanic I felt was very clear and helpful, especially in the fact that, you know, if there is a opening, unless it's a true out and out secret, but if there's an opening between, you know, like an area where you haven't explored yet, there'll be a little opening in the map to kind of denote a door. That was super awesome because literally at one point I was sitting there with the map up, just staring at it. And then I kind of like stepped outside of myself and realized that this is the equivalent of Alucard, like rolling his map out on the table and just like staring at it, you know, and like being like, there has to be this ring somewhere. Where in this shifting castle is it? You know? So I don't know. I really appreciated that moment. You kind of touched on one of them, which is that items actually change, like your sword changes, your cloak changes. I just want to hit on that again really briefly, because that is very new for this time. You know, like not all games at that. Now with all of our modern gaming, we're like, of course, if you equip a different shield, it looks different. But I mean, I remember playing tons of RPGs where you got the, you know, plus 10 orc banisher. I've got an ogre slaying knife that's plus 9 against ogres, right? Like you had that versus like your wooden sword, and they all just looked the same. You just had to know that it was more powerful. So the fact that the game was doing that is a good use of their computational power. And then, so this is one of the ones that this was just such a cool animation, which is your double jump looks like bat wings, like right. Your cloak kind of opens up and like pushes down. And I'm always really fascinated in games with how they justify a double jump, you know, because it's a great mechanic. It works really, really well mechanically, but then it's just kind of like, okay, well, and for some games they're like, look, man, you can jump twice. It's cartoony enough, deal with it. But the two that I always think about is one is in Devil May Cry. When you get the double jump, it actually creates like a magical ruin beneath your feet. So you're basically creating a small pocket of something you can step on. Yeah. And then you are jumping again. I'm like,
which is, that's cool looking as hell.
Yeah. It's really visually stunning and also makes sense in universe. So the fact it's like, basically when you get this ability, you know, your cloak is kind of opening up into this kind of magical bat wing and giving you one additional push into the air. Feels awesome. Looks awesome. Just fantastic. So little attention to details like that, kind of as you were saying, are just tens across the board.
And in a world where it would have been so easy to lazily say, like, he's magic, you can just jump twice. It's like, yeah. No, but how is he, the world still has physics. How is he doing it? Right. And that's just like, someone thought about that. And the conversation probably went like, oh, we're going to give him a double jump, because then we can, like, you know, region lock stuff behind the double jump. And it's like, yeah, bat wings might be cool. Bat wings would be cool. You should animate bat wings.
Actually, this is definitely slightly tangential, but I always do appreciate games, any media that takes magic and somehow tries to rationalize it. It's supposed to, like, because if you just say, oh, it's magic, a wizard did it, like, that's not satisfying, you know. But one of the ones that so in D&D, right, because of course it comes back to D&D, right, is, and I think we've had this conversation, which is, it's like, well, you know, magic, like, how does that work exactly? You know, because it's magic, right? So I actually was able to use that recently when I was talking to Megan, and we were talking about transmutation in general. And we're like, well, how does that work? It's more specifically in Harry Potter, because I said, like, okay, wait. So McGonagall can, like, transform herself into a cat, but the cat doesn't weigh, you know, 70 kilograms, right? The cat's a cat, right? So I'm like, so that gets a little fuzzy, because it's not like Envy in Brotherhood where they always have like that additional weight, you know. So what I said is, I was like, oh, so what if there was like a pocket universe filled with near infinite energy, and magic simply is able to access that pocket universe, right, and then pull energy from or dump energy into it and then transform it into matter, right? Because then basically what McGonagall is doing is taking a tremendous amount of mass, transferring it into energy, and then moving it into this pocket dimension, and then pulling it out and transmuting it back into herself when she's done. And that's what the spell is, you know. Now all of that's way overthinking it. That's not the point. But the point is I really appreciate games that take that kind of thought and attention to detail, as opposed to being like, I don't know, it's magic. Magic can do anything. It's like, no, let's set up a universe where it makes sense. And this game does that pretty much every step of the way, you know, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah. And the last thing I'll say about the visuals, I just, because I didn't want to interrupt you before, but the thing about the map that I appreciate is, because I have a hard experience with maps. Like, I could do a whole like dissertation on my relationship with video game maps, but the thing that a lot of Metroidvanias do, and this, sorry, backtrackers, the thing a lot of backtrackers do is the map doesn't give you a ton of information, because part of the challenge is remembering where the thing was. And now that I need to go back to the thing that I, because I got the thing in the other place, I can go back to the other place and use the thing, is like remembering or wandering aimlessly. And something this map does pretty well, because it has no detail, right, it is almost completely useless, is, other than save spots, teleportation spots, and doors, which are all useful bits of information, no doubt. One of the few things that it does is the design of the map communicates enough information to jog your memory, right? The cathedral that's like up in the top left has that giant staircase that's incredibly annoying with those stupid fire-breathing like dinosaur heads on it. Like, you immediately can remember that that's what's up there when you look at that on the map, because nowhere else on the map is shaped like that, right? When you see the giant vertical shaft in the dead center of the map, you're like, oh, that's the clock room. That's where the clock is, right? The outer wall is like this ridiculously vertical section on the right side, right? Like there's the Colosseum. Yeah, the Colosseum like weirdly shoots off from the center and you have to like go and find that whole area because none of it's on the map that you buy. Like there's someone thought about what I'm going to call the silhouette of that map, right? Like if you just blacked the whole thing out and all you had was the map part and nothing else, you could still say like, oh, there's the cathedral, there's the Colosseum, there's the outer wall, right? There's the clock room, there's Dracula's room up at the top there, because it like weirdly juts off and is like a big pain in the butt to get to until you can transform into the bat, right? Like there's a lot of thought put into, we're not going to give you the information, but we will give you all of these like mental triggers to remember, like, oh, that, okay, now I'm looking for the room that shoots off of the cathedral. And the cathedral's up there, and I know it's up there because it's got that specific shape.
Yeah, no, I agreed. Anything else for visuals?
No, I think I'm going to save that for mechanics. Yes, I'm ready for audio.
Okay, well, I'll let you you take point because you're going to do the autumn to my fall of autumn is when things change and are beautiful, and I'm like, leaves fall down. So, you know, take it away. What do you think of the music?
I liked it.
You see, I felt that there was a beautiful counter.
No, the thing about the music in this game is not just how good it is, but someone sat down with the music team and said, hey, listen, we're going to have this incredibly varied looking universe, a lot of rich environments, a lot of crazy variations, a lot of which doesn't need to make sense because the castle itself is magical, so we can do all sorts of bonkers things, make no damn sense inside the castle. You need music to go with all that. So we have like 25 areas or 50 areas or however many areas it is. Can you write a unique piece of music for each one of those? And also, I'm thinking 6 to 10 different genres would be great. I need symphony orchestra. I need heavy rock. I need light rock. I need some of those like weird kind of spooky ambient songs that aren't really songs. You can't hum them. Like, what a challenge to set these poor people, because you know the music came after, right? They wrote music to fit the environments. So the art team got to decide what environments to do, and then the music team definitely had to come in behind and just be like, oh geez, there's like 30 different unique environments. Like we've gotta write music for all of them, and so help me God, we're gonna do it. And they do it.
Yeah. So if I had to guess what probably happened, and again, not being an industry expert, I don't know for sure, is that they probably did like concept art for all of the different areas that they wanted to do, and then basically said like, okay, you know, that they said like, okay, now go build the dungeons, like build them out mechanically so they make sense, make sure that you're getting the silhouette on the map so that way it works, all this sort of stuff. And then at the same point in time, they said, I want the music to feel how this area feels. You know, so like, because that's basically, I mean, you know, when you're in the cathedral, the music feels like you're in a cathedral, you know, whereas when you're, you know, like running like a madman to get into Dracula's tower, you know, like it's and you're doing the, you know, I've got all of the awesome items that I'm going to lose because that's that sucks. Kind of ubiquitously true, but you know, like that's got a different feel to it, you know? So yeah, so I think that basically they said, you know, sorry, this is again a little tangential, but basically at one point I had there was one person I was talking to, and they said, they sneezed, and it was like one of those ridiculous sneezes where it was like, phew, you know, something like that. And like, they saw my eyes go like wide and they're like, ah, no, you are only allowed to say something if it's something I haven't heard before. And I said, your sneezes sound like baby kittens look. And they said, yeah, all right, that is new. I have not heard that before. But like, that's kind of where, like, all of these things sound like the area looks. So that's why I have to believe that they said, like, we want this to be like a cavern, and this is going to look like this, and this is going to look like this. Now make the music. No limitations. It doesn't have to be, like you said, it's not like it all has to be symphony music. It's like, no limitations. Whatever you need to make this sound like it looks, do it. And they did, and it's great.
Yeah, this immediately jumped onto my list of game soundtracks I will now listen to while I work. Although I did have to put an asterisk with it, because a lot of the songs are songs, like they don't have lyrics except for the end title song, and that's its own thing. But they
which is super fun to sit through with a four-year-old on your lap, because I beat the game and I was like, okay, I need to get to the, because I didn't know that it wasn't like a new game plus where like you had to go about it, and so I thought it was like after the credits, like a thing was going to happen where the other castle comes down or whatever, right? And so I'm just sitting there with my impatient four-year-old going like, Dada, what's going on? No, it's going to be great. No, it's going to be great. And it just ended. And I was like, oh, man, I'm a liar.
It was so, not great. but I like a lot of the songs are like they have a discernible melody. Right. And so that makes them less optimal for like focus music, because then you catch yourself. I at least catch myself singing along. Right. So I do listen to this music while I work, but there's probably certain kinds of work that I can't do with this on, because otherwise I'll just be imagining I'm Richter running to fight Dracula, like,
right. You know what I have found the soundtrack's really good for?
Working out. Yeah, it is. Yeah,
it totally is.
Although you don't want to have just like failed on a set, you know, depending on what kind of workout you're doing, like you don't want to have just failed on a set during like the spooky like underwater like ice cavern music, or the like the death music, like, or the not death, the like ferryman who like rows you, because those songs, like, those are not, you know, then you have to be sad until like the Coliseum music comes on and you're like, yeah.
Well, so what I actually have been doing, I've been doing kung fu to this stuff, and that works out really well, because then like when it's slower, you do like more slow, like relaxed sets, right? And then like when it ramps up, you know, then I'm, because like when it's slower, I am training for the battle, and when it's rocking, I am in the battle, you know. So same form, just the difference is I'm fighting bad guys when it's rocking, and it's pretty good. The downside though is I'm not, you know, 22 anymore, so sometimes I'll get a little too into it and I'll just be like, oh, wait, hang on.
My not 20-year-old back.
like I definitely, you know, I threw that kick, it was a great kick, I'm really happy with it, but I can definitely feel that my hammies are going to be a little sore tomorrow.
So we do, if we're going to talk about audio, we do have to be clear on a specific detail. Usually you and I are able to play the same original copy of the game, right? Every once in a while we have to go to like the, you know, Switch, like the virtual store on Nintendo, or like the re-release like of all the Sega Genesis games on a single disc, right? But most of the time those games are exactly like their originals, or so close that it's irrelevant to get nitpicky about it. In this case, you played the PSP re-release on the PS4, and I played the PlayStation 1 original. And mechanically, everything is the same. There's the graphics are all the same. Everything's the same except the voice acting. All the voice acting in your version was a better translation, and then they had to re-record it with new voice actors. I sort of adore the terrible voice acting because I have nostalgia goggles for it. I can't recommend it. Some of the sentences people say make no sense, and it sounds like they're acted by first year acting students, which they might be. But like the,
it might have just not been acted by acting students at all. It might have just been the staff. Just, you know?
But I mean, the performances are all good. It, you know what it is? It's the Star Wars prequels. Like, you can take someone like Alucard's voice actor has an amazing voice, and I'm sure he's a talented voice actor. But if you give him kind of hammy, awful dialogue, right? Natalie Portman is a super talented actress, but when you give her the Star Wars prequels, she looks terrible. She sounds like a crazy person because that's what she was told to do by the director, right? And so nothing against the voice actors themselves, but they were probably given a lot of like, you know, yeah, this is, it's a video game, so like really ham it up and like be silly with it. And it's like, no, it can be serious. So I'm actually mostly curious, how did you feel about the voice acting? Because you got all the redone stuff.
I did get all the redone stuff because I didn't have a copy of this game because I was on the right side of the console wars, you know? So
yeah, that,
I
that's
didn't,
boring
you know,
out.
Have the filthy, no, I'm not finished. I didn't have any of that filthy PlayStation garbage in my house. All of that being said, yeah, no, I thought the voice acting was, it was fine. It wasn't bad. So I think that the thing was, like in the original one, is it was kind of the Rocky Horror Picture Show of kind of voice acting, in the sense that it's so weird and so campy that it kind of becomes beloved. Yeah,
it's,
you know,
it's fun.
Because I don't think anybody would look at the Rocky Horror Picture Show movie and say like, this is clearly, you know, like a plus list movie. I mean, that's the whole point, is that it's like a weird B sci-fi flick, you know. So I think that this voice acting is better, but it's good enough that you don't notice it, because it just kind of a little bit carries the plot along. Like, it is literally there as just a needle that delivers plot juice into your brain, you know? So that's kind of all it does. So I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. I nothinged it, but I wasn't there for the voice acting. I'm not really in that thing for the horribly cerebral plot, you know, like it's you know.
Yeah, and that's a fair thing to dwell on, is hammy original voice acting, or probably perfectly fine redone voice acting. There isn't a ton, right? There's not a ton of spoken dialogue, and even in the segments that have spoken dialogue, the conversations are fairly short because you want to get back to killing demons. Like, you know, I'm here to occasionally talk to Maria and kill demons, and Maria's in a room I can't get to yet. So it's like, you just, you know, Death is like, hey, you shouldn't be here. And Alucard's like, yeah, but I am. And then that cutscene is over. Right. And when you talk to Maria the first time, you're like, hey, and she's like, hey, you seen this guy? Nah. Okay. Right. Like, there's just the cutscenes are fairly concise, which helps a lot, because 30 hours of terrible hammy voice acting, I probably would not remember fondly, right? Like, I want to get back to stabbing demons. That is what I'm here for.
I would say there's about as much dialogue overall, and it serves a similar purpose, where it's like, you know, this is not a narratively driven game. Narrative is not a core aesthetic. You know, you're not playing this game to understand the deep and complex relationship between Richter, Shaft, and Alucard. You know, like, that's not what you're in it for. It is a very Bowser-esque villain, where the villain is simply there to make you play the game, you know, to give you some kind of a semblance of reason. So with that in mind, I think that there's probably about as much dialogue, there is voice acting to it, but as there is in like Super Mario Brothers 3, you know, where it's like, the princess is in another castle. Hey, you know, like, thank you very much for saving me, Mario. You know, like, Bowser passed through here, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, it's a little bit more heady and philosophical, like, what is a man? Which, I mean, of course they changed. But, you know, that's more fitting with the aesthetic of being gothic than, you know, anything to say like, oh no, they really cared about like your investment on the plot of this. So yeah, like I said, like the difference is before it was like a like thing A. What did you just say? And now it's just like thing A. It's like, yes, thing A makes sense. Thank you. It's more like a board meeting than a board meeting housed by somebody who's just dropped like a comical amount of acid before coming into the board meeting. Like a truly heroic amount of acid, you know? Like
I don't know if it was that bad originally, but I mean, I've never done acid, so maybe that would be amazing.
I just like the idea of someone being like, what happened last night? It's like, I do not know, man. You did a truly heroic amount of acid. Like, and that is what heroes do.
And you flapped your bat wings and double jumped off into the night and didn't see you again until this morning.
Just shows him broken at the bottom of like. It's like, why is he so beat up like that? He was on the first floor when he jumped.
I will. The last thing I want to mention about the sound effects, just because I've in recent episodes, I feel like I've harped on this a handful of times. And for a game that has, you know, a dozen spells and a bajillion monsters and 1,000 different weapons and all of this stuff going on all the damn time, I do not remember coming across any sound effects that were like tinny or screechy, which is, I think, actually like worth noting, because there's a lot of monsters that it probably would have been really low hanging fruit to be like, oh, this thing needs to make a noise, like to signify that it's about to attack or something. So give it a screechy demonic, like they don't do that. And I appreciate that. I don't like those kinds of noises. It can be done well, like when you have enough audio power, and the PlayStation certainly did, but it's really easy to push it too far and just have something that is like screechy and, you know, nails on a chalkboardy, just to be like, oh, but that's, you know, what the magic sphere sounds like when it explodes. It's like the screechy noise, or that's what it sounds like when the demon is excised. It's just this screechy noise. I'm like, no, just don't, like, do something more interesting than that, or just don't give it a sound. Like, I hate those kind of like super tinny, super screechy, scratchy sorts of noises. And there's nowhere in the game, at least that I came across, that I was like, oh God. Like, and I played a lot of this with headphones on, so I feel like I would have noticed, or at least they happened so few and far between that it didn't get under my skin the way it does sometimes. So like, good. Thank you. Like, you know, for the sound designers that had to make a bajillion and a half different sound effects to go with all the different visual nonsense going on. Like, thank you for not going to that particular well.
I would definitely agree with you, with one exception. And again, since I played the PS4 version, I don't know if this is a difference. The Ice Maidens dying.
Like, oh yeah, they kind of go like, ah.
Yeah. So that was really high pitched. Now, that being said, it was coming through my controller. So that. Yeah.
Yeah. No. So that speaker is what's the word? Awful.
Not made for that. Yeah. Not made for being a speaker. Yeah. So I think that's the problem there, is that, you know, so I would definitely go with your assessment over mine, because that was the only place where I ran into it. Everywhere else it was fine, but like the first time I killed one of them, I was like, man. Now I'm going to play this game on hard mode, because I have to get through the rest of it without killing any more of these people. You know?
Yeah, I think that's a great example, though, because in, you know, the correct version of the game, that sound is very high pitched, but it's very clear and crisp. Whereas the PS4 controller speaker, I think, is actually just a tin can, and it's connected to a PS1 version of the game somewhere else. And so you were hearing it, you know, through the tin can over the string. And that's why it sounded like grating, right? Because high pitch.
Oh my God, it sounded tinny. How did you miss that?
No,
it was from a tin can.
Yeah, I know. Okay. I was going to get there.
Oh, sorry. Oh no, now I feel stupid.
But I
ruined it.
I do think it's fair to be specific enough to say there's a difference between high pitched and screeching, right? Screeching is a timber as much as a pitch. And that particular enemy, you're absolutely, and there's a couple other enemies that have a similar kind of like blood curdling woman death scream from like a horror movie. But on, if it's coming through your regular television speakers, you would not have felt that way. At least I didn't. And I don't think you would have, because God, the PS4 speaker on the controller is so bad.
But yeah, no, I didn't really have any two other big notes for audio. You?
No, just except to thank you for recommending that I try working out to this, because I'm going to do that.
It's good. It's real good. Yeah. No, especially like I said, man, it starts to ramp up, and all of a sudden I'm surrounded by bad guys and I'm the only one that can stop them. And like I said, the only downside is when you get a little too into it. And then, yeah. And but the nice thing is that it's almost, this is going to be a little tangential, but
you're so shy with your tangents tonight.
I don't know why. I don't know why. But anyways, it's more like is the issue is that it can kind of be like Goku post Kaioken 4, you know, where like you get super into it for like 15, 20 minutes, you know, and then all of a sudden you're like, all right, and like all of this, like it hits a lull in the music, and then you'll kind of go to do it and you drop out of your Kaioken, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh wait, I am exhausted, you know, like, and then you kind of go back upstairs and you're drenched in sweat, and then the next day you're like, why am I racked with pain? Oh right, because I was jumping around like a 21-year-old for, you know, 30 minutes, and I can't really do that anymore. I'm not that athletic.
Sounds like a way to get a good workout in, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it'll get the job done. It'll get you there. So, gameplay. So here's one of the things that we've kind of already touched on briefly just between the two of us, which is that, so spoilers, I don't generally like backtrackers / Metroidvanias, yeah, right?
But, shocking. But plot twist, which one of us said we should play this game?
Me. Me, I did. I said we should play this game because, and here's the thing is that I feel that as you get older, not to say that I'm like wizened by any means.
No one would say that.
No one would. No one that knows me for any length of time. in the death battle analogy, I think you're Wiz and I'm Boomstick, but and it's up to us to analyze their weapons, armor, and skill to determine does this game hold up. But God, don't at me for that, screwing it up. Anyways, that's not the point. The point is that as you get older, you kind of realize your own kind of, I guess, bad habits, you know? And one of mine is that, like, sometimes I will get just super into something for, like, a 2-3 week period, and then it's dead to me forever, you know? And, I mean, as long as this is almost exclusively with things that are recreation related, which is fine, because the purpose of recreation is that it is bringing me joy. So I will do it intensely for the amount of time that it brings me joy, and then when it ceases to bring me joy, I stop doing it. I said all that to say, I do not know why, but I was super into Castlevania, like the show. I was like listening to the music. I was like way into it. I'm like, now is the time. We have like a 2-week window-ish, because I'm just, for whatever reason, super into like this media right now. Let's do it right now. And you're like, okay. So yeah, it was entirely my call. Yes, so don't generally like Metroidvanias. But I liked this one. People will know now. But I liked this one, and it was very clear to me immediately the big difference, which is that this has RPG mechanics to it. You level up, you gain items beyond things that improve your abilities, like that give you new abilities. So, but most importantly is you're always gaining experience, you're always gaining gold. So if I sat down and wandered around aimlessly for 20 minutes, like having no idea where to go, which absolutely happened in this game, I didn't feel like I had just thrown away 20 minutes of my life. That I just, you know, I was like, well, I'm a little frustrated because I feel like I've been trying to make progress in this thing and I have made nil progress. I haven't gotten any better at the game because everything I've been doing is easy. I can do it. I'd already been able to do it. I just don't know where to go. The RPG mechanics completely blunted that feeling for me, which actually, to me, I was like, well, this is the thing that I now have enough data to show that this is something that I think is a key difference for some people that don't like Metroidvanias, because another game that I really, really enjoyed that is a Metroidvania-esque was Dead Cells, and Dead Cells had RPG mechanics. So I think that that can actually take some people that are not into Metroidvanias and turn them onto them. So yeah, that's a big key difference between this game and a lot of other Metroidvanias backtrackers.
I mean, literally, because there, I have some stuff in mechanics I definitely want to talk about, but literally my first thing in my notes is George and backtrackers, because when I think we were texting and you were like, you know, yeah, I really feel like the RPG elements make getting lost not feel like a total waste. It's less productive, but productivity doesn't drop to zero, right? And I just, like, I literally went and then talked with two other people that day. And I was like, I never thought about that, because I don't like getting lost in a backtracker, but it doesn't ruin the experience for me the way it does for you. And so I like the RPG elements being there because I like RPG elements. But to me, they were frosting on a cake I would happily eat without frosting, right? Whereas for you, it's like peanut butter on a peanut butter sandwich. You're like, this is just bread without peanut butter on it. Right. So it's like, that was, I was so like excited, I think, like when you shared that comment with me, cause I was like, oh my God, I hadn't even separated those two mechanics in my mind, because so many modern backtrackers have RPG elements that it's just like, they just go together. Right. It's become like a lot of the modern Zelda games have been critiqued for following the Zelda formula. And a lot of backtrackers are pulling directly from this game, which hilariously, the creators of Symphony of the Night did not believe that they were ripping off Super Metroid, even though, oh my God, they so obviously are. Their inspiration was The Legend of Zelda. Like, they wanted you to feel like you were getting lost, feel like you were exploring this large hostile place where you didn't really know where to go and what to do. And that feeling is totally there, right? But the RPG elements are why, the reason those RPG elements are there is because what they were inspired by was Zelda, which has more in common with RPGs in most people's minds than Super Metroid has in common with RPGs, where you do get upgrades, but they're fixed, they're predictable, there's a limit, right? You can't just grind enemies in Metroid games. So that like, I was excited that you were excited about this, because it reframed my entire understanding of the individual ingredients in the cake.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it is, and this is kind of why what we touched on before, where you can't judge a game, you can't describe a game simply by the mechanics involved. You know, I mean, it can't say like, well, I mean, I love first person shooters, like, you know, Portal 2, you know,
Battlefield,
like Half-Life.
Oh wait, those have nothing in common.
Yeah, exactly. Those are completely different experiences. Like, but they're all first person shooters. I mean, like, even, you know, when we talk about like backtrackers, right, is that, you know, it's I think that, and I've kind of mentioned this before as well, it's that, like, I think that they are a subgenre of the genre of unfolding games, because both Zelda and Metroid unfold, you know, but like they do so in a very decidedly different way, because in Legend of Zelda, you're exploring this kind of huge area, and then you kind of get, but you're not like forcibly like kind of backtracking consistently. You know, it's more like you're exploring this grander land. It has a completely different feel to it, you know, but at the same point in time, as if you said like, well, do you get upgrades and do you backtrack? Yes. Well, then it's a backtracker. And it's like, well, no, this isn't really, you know, it's very difficult. So yeah, I do think that the RPG elements completely change it. So if somebody says, I don't like Metroidvanias, I mean, especially because the mainstream genre, it's right in the name to be like, try this Castlevania game because it's different than Metroid, you know? So when you say like, it's a Metroidvania, it's like Metroid and Castlevania aren't even the same, man. So that being said, there are definitely some really obtuse logical leaps that you have to make in order to get through this game, to the point where I looked up my new infinite page Nintendo Power, which is what I call the internet. I had to go on to that a couple of times in order to get to where I needed to be. The biggest one that I'll waggle my finger at, because there's definitely a lot of them where I was able to make pretty solid progress without looking anything up. But when I got stuck, I generally got stuck pretty hard. And the worst one, man, is I forget what ability it is that you get. It's right before, I think it's after you get the double jump, that you're supposed to go to the clock room and wait for an odd numbered hour or an even numbered hour, because the entrance is not always open. So first of all, the layout of that area does not make you think, I need my double jump to get there. In the library, absolutely. I was thinking like, oh man, if I had a double jump, I could get there. In that wherever towards the top with those giant skull things that I hated, you know, those, I was like, man, if I had a double jump, I could clear this length of jump, you know. Nothing about that room made me think that I would need a double jump. So when I passed through it again two or three times, I just happened to not be there when the entrance was open. So I just never even thought about it until I looked it up and I was like, oh, come on. And I think that any time in a game where you say, come on, like that's not great, especially if the goal was like, you know, hey, here's a puzzle, figure it out. And then you get the answer and you're like, I feel like that wasn't on me. That's an issue. So the entire game wasn't like that. Otherwise, I'd have to be increasingly frustrated. But there were definitely some like logic spikes. Like if we say like there's like difficulty spikes, there are like spikes in logic that's required from me that were a little steep.
Well, I think it's interesting to call out the design of that room, because it's reasonable to think that at some point you might be able to fly, or that you might be able to travel vertically more than the double jump. So it's reasonable to assume that there are places that even the double jump can't get you, right? You see a couple like big, tall vertical shafts that are really narrow and there's no platforms to land on, right? So you might make the intuitive leap that you can eventually fly or travel vertically in some other way. The thing about that room, because I thought about that, because a lot of people get stuck with the moving statues, because one of them you control with the time, the stopwatch sub-weapon, and the other one just, you know, opens and closes every other minute. I think you said an hour, but I think it's every other minute.
Yeah.
When you go into that room for the very first time, no matter what minute it is, that one is open. And when you are talking to Maria, it closes. It very obviously visually closes, and it makes a loud like marble stone scraping noise as it the statue like slides back into place. And I remember thinking on this playthrough, I don't think that would have given me enough information if I didn't already know what to do. Like, it definitely got my attention, but I have no... I don't think I was given enough information to make the intuitive leap to, oh, it opens and closes periodically, right? So the only thing I could think of is that maybe they were just hoping you would stand in that room long enough thinking about how do I open that, right? As opposed to going in and being like, oh, it's closed, right? And I can't imagine some players like getting into that room and just being like, okay, well, I have the double jump, but when I jump into it, it doesn't move. And if I jump up there and I swing my sword at it, like it doesn't move. Maybe there's like a spell. And like while they were going through that process, time would just be passing and then it would open. But I don't like that. Like, even if that is what they were going for, I still don't like that.
See, a better way to force that would be to put enemies in that room.
Oh, so that you have to stay in there.
Well, so like enemies that you could like walk through, you know, like maybe some like flying enemy or something like that, where like if you're just barreling through the room, you might be able to bypass it. But then like if you spend the time to like swat at and kill the bad guy, that is way more likely to generate enough time for you to have been in the room long enough for it to open. Like, so there are enemies in the room before it and after it. And there are those horrible flea dudes
flea men.
That are an impregnable pain in the ass to kill. So like, if they had just put two of those dudes in there, absolutely you would have stopped long enough for that door to open, you know? So that makes me think that they were actually trying to occlude it, not draw attention to it. You know, which is, it's fine. Again, like it's not, if the entire game was like that, I'd be like, come on guys, you're just beating me up to beat me up, you know? But I really think that this was more of a like, no, we really want them to be paying attention, and we want this to be an area where they get cut off and they explore the whole area that they can three or four times to find all of the extra stuff we've hidden around. We want this to blunt their forward momentum through the game, you know? I just think that you know, when I was a DM, one of the first puzzles I ever put in an adventure took the entire group 2 hours before I gave them the answer. And then I never put a puzzle in an adventure again. which you yourself have borne witness to, because I think you one time said like, yeah, man, like you never really put any puzzles in there. I'm like, nope, I don't. I had a bad experience. So this is kind of like that, where I think they're like, oh, we'll do this to kind of blunt their momentum a little bit. It's like, wrong. You have blunted the momentum entirely for like 90% of the populace, you know? Can you suss it out? Yes. Are you likely to? No. Does it break the game? No. You know, I mean, you just got to eventually either know a friend, have Nintendo Power, or play it 10 years later and have the internet, you know?
Well, and I think first off, there's no way this game was in Nintendo Power, which is funny, but anyway.
Sorry, it's the only publication I know, because I don't read your terrible propaganda, whatever you read.
Your filth rags.
Comrade.
So negative. So I it was either, it might have been Game Maker's Toolkit, but someone exposed me to the idea of, in a backtracker or an unfolding game, because I really like both of those as a way to describe this, the you can measure the verticality or horizontalness of the access to the map by charting out how much of the map do you get access to at the start, and then each one of your power-ups, right? In Dead Cells, there's certain spots on the ground that you can only break if you have the like down, you know, ground pound. And then, you know, once you have the double jump, you can do this and blah, 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 right? And like, that's a thing that basically all backtrackers have in common, is you get something, a power, an item, a whatever, that allows you to then get to a place or do a thing you couldn't do before. And that opens up more of the world, right? And this game, and this is true of a lot of backtrackers, is really double jump heavy. A lot of the map becomes accessible to you when you get the double jump. Like, a lot of the map is behind the double jump, and then basically everything else is behind flight. Because where can't you go, right? The only other places that you're blocked are the mist gates, and there's, I think, literally two or three of them in the entire game, right? So
yeah, the mist gates are similar to like the blue doors, where it's just like you got this ability for the sole purpose of getting past these two or three obstacles. Yes. You know?
Yeah, and that's certainly an incredibly difficult design challenge. This game also makes use of one-way doors, where it's like, I don't need anything special, I just need to have come here from the other direction. So eventually this room will connect this space and that space, but not until I come, you know, heading east to west or whatever. And that's all fine. Like, these are all tools in the tool belt, but like, double jump is really aggressively used. And what I think they failed at with the clock room is that's one of the only puzzles in the entire game, right? Everything else is made accessible through either exploration or power upgrades. That's, I think, literally like one of the only puzzles in the entire game.
Well, I think one of the other puzzles, just to, and I would agree with you, you know, I didn't really think of it that way, but it's basically everything else is, it's like, I need to get there. I don't have the ability, not there is a puzzle I need to figure out. One of the other puzzles that, again, I think just juxtaposes how absurd the intellectual spike is on this one, is getting the two rings to get the semi-real ending, which is, one of them says like, where dot dot clock, and the other one says in dot dot tower. So when you have both, it's where in clock tower, right? That's it. That's the whole puzzle. Like when you have both things, like honestly, when I got one of the rings, I knew what to do, you know. It's like, but you know, when you get two, then you it's very clear. So that would be arguably another puzzle, right? But that's it. Like that's
and the no question worst part about that puzzle, and this is gonna sound like stupid complaint, but it drives me nuts every time. It drove me nuts on this playthrough, right? Even though I've played this game 24 times. You have to get the bat sonar, which you use once to go through mm-hmm. the spike room, which is dark, and you never do that again, even though that's a really interesting little mechanic. They never play with that again. And then you get the spike breaker armor, which you need to
go down once
to go down one hallway. And then Maria is in that room and the other ring is in that room. How did she get into that room? She is not magic. She has magic, but like she can't transform into mist, which you had to do to go through the mist gate. She clearly does not have the spike breaker armor because all of the spikes are intact. How did she get into that room? This drives me nuts because not only is that an annoying puzzle, but the tiny little bit of story that's wrapped around that part of the puzzle makes no damn sense. It's like confusing for the sake of being confusing.
It absolutely is. I can rationalize it, but this is just for fun. Your point is absolutely well taken. She should not be in there. What if Maria the entire time is in that last room where you find her in that weird looking room, right?
Yeah, occult.
Yeah. So what if she's in there the whole time and she's simply projecting herself every other time you see her?
Yeah, which that raises another question. How the hell does she get into that room?
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, that would be. But I mean, that room seems like one where like she got in there and now like can't get out. You know, like I believe that she was exploring the castle, then got trapped in one area. And that just happens to be the horror show that she got trapped in, you know. Because I mean that feels right, you know. Like, is that anybody who's not Alucard would like get stuck somewhere because they can't turn into mist or a bat or a wolf or flap their bat cloak or yeah. I don't know all the other stuff he can do. So you know, that's my rationalization. It's not great.
In the version of the game you played, one of the things they added from the Japanese release that hadn't ever been in the US for whatever reason is you can play as Maria and she has mm-hmm. insane movement abilities because she doesn't get any upgrades, right? So like you can play through the entire game as Richter, and Richter, if you like link his movement abilities together, he can get places you would normally have to fly to by like doing his like uppercut kick thing like over and over, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a de facto kind of flight, and the way Maria moves is bonkers. Like I watched a speed run of the game for Alucard, for Richter, and for Maria, and Maria's is by far the most Looney Tunes. Like she's just zipping around like it's as if someone is holding onto her sprite with like the arrow cursor and just dragging her around the screen, right? Like the way a child would take like a paper doll and just move it against the static background. Like
nice.
Because they didn't want to totally just reinvent the entire game around her. So they just gave her like this ludicrous moveset, but you don't see any of that in the main story. She just walks in and out of rooms. You never see her fight. I don't even know if you ever see her jump. You see her do like a little hop up a couple steps, but like mm-hmm. nothing about what you see in the main game would indicate that she should be able to get to any of the places you interact with her. So it's like every time I go into a room and she's there, I'm just like, yeah, okay. How'd you get in here?
I just imagine Alucard saying that. One thing I did want to make sure that I touched on is so at the beginning you got baller equipment, right? And then death takes it all from you. Death comes for us all. So I just made me think of the John Oliver thing. It's like where he's talking about how you can't just completely change a quote out of context because some politician was changing the bring us your tired, your poor, your masses yearning to be free. Uh-huh. And he's like, you know, it's like, because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. And then we totally the lot death. But anyway, it just makes me think. Yeah, so anyway, so because I would not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. None of that's going to be usable. Anyways,
just throw this whole episode in the bin. Start it all over.
All right. Hey, Lions, how's it going? So, but I actually learned what that's called, because a lot of games do that where they say, like, here's what you'll be like at the end of the game. Okay, now we're going to take all of your abilities away. And especially backtrackers, unfolding games, Metroidvanias in particular, are notorious for this, because they want you to know that the horribly hamstrung way with which you are interacting with the universe will change and get better, right? Do you know the actual word for that? It's pretty elegant. Mm. Abilities.
Ooh.
Right? So, yes. So there is an abilities at the beginning of this game.
That journey was absolutely worth going on just to get to that payoff, by the way. So all of the nonsense that preceded that has got to stay in, because it was worth the journey. That juice was worth the squeeze every bit.
Woohoo! Good to know. So all this is true. I really do think that an abilities is important in a game like this, because, you know, you really feel like an amazing, powerful badass, like, at the beginning. And then I felt that it was good the way narratively that your abilities were stripped from you, because it's not like then somebody came in like Richter, you know, comes in and like gut punches you and you lose all your best stuff. You're like, that's the best stuff. Like, it's the best stuff. So who took support? Death. Death himself had to come in and take all of your stuff away and say, like, okay, now go deal with this nonsense. You know, so that felt, it didn't feel flippant having it taken from you, the act in which it was taken from you, unlike, I don't know, like a Metroid game where all of a sudden you're restricted from using your best equipment because your CEO has told you not to use it. Hypothetically,
just,
right?
Just saying.
So, but all that being said is I do think that portion of Metroidvanias is very important, because it lets you know what you're in for if you stick with it, which I thought was pretty good.
Well, and just to tie that back to like the ham-fisted dialogue and everything is, you know what communicates to the player a lot of useful narrative information about the Castlevania universe? Death is not in charge. He works for Dracula, right?
Like, yes.
I think that's actually been true in all of the Castlevania games, that Death is like a servant, or at least, you know, a co-founder of Dracula Incorporated. Like, yeah. I really feel like that tells you something when you go into a room and the literal specter of Death is like, hey, stop it. And it's like, yeah. Why? It's like, because you're here to kill my boss. Right, it's like, I'm not gonna let you do that. And I feel like, ham-fisted dialogue aside, that tells you a lot about what this universe is like, how big and powerful and scary Dracula is, right? Because in this game we've only seen Richter totally eat his lunch, and we need to kind of have our levels reset, because it's like, oh, Richter defeated Dracula, but now Dracula's back. How do we know that Dracula's scary when you just defeated him in a battle you can't lose? Oh, because one of his middle managers is Death, right? Like, that's...
Death himself.
Yeah, I like that kind of way of, like, level setting you, right? Kind of resetting your expectations. Here's how powerful you're going to be. Here's someone you know is less powerful than the guy you're trying to go fight, and he just jacked all your stuff, right? That quickly aligns your expectations.
It does. And to wax nostalgic one final time about the TV show, similarly, they do something similar in the show, where basically it's just kind of like, okay, well, how powerful is Dracula? It's like, well, all of these other vampires report directly to him. It's like, yeah, but maybe all those other vampires suck. So, like, at the end of season two, you know, like, it basically, and not to do too many spoilers for the TV show, but like, it takes everyone throwing everything they have in the kitchen sink at Dracula, and he still is just walking through everybody, even though the entire season he is walking around an empty hollow shell of a person. And like, noticeably, they say, like, he's not drinking, he's not eating, he's you know, he is at like 10% of his true power, and still everything you can possibly do to stop him ain't really getting the job done. So, you know, like that, that again, it scales like how impossible this thing is. I think that a lot of the times in video games and in media, it's what helps scale our reaction isn't the game can all day long say like Dracula super powerful. Is instead it's the how the characters react to Dracula. So the fact that like in the TV show and also in this game, whenever Dracula's referenced, it's like, dude, don't mess with Dracula. Like, he's terrifying, you know? And so you've got like Alucard who's saying like, I have to do something. My father has to be stopped, but he's horrifying, you know? Or like, I have to do something about like this castle because he's just finding the castle, you know? But everybody is terrified of Dracula. So we know how powerful Alucard is. We're Alucard. And the fact that Alucard is terrified of Dracula, Maria is terrified of Dracula, everybody's just terrified of the castle, you know, and that's, and even though it doesn't have Dracula in it, like that does help scale the experience.
Yeah. There's a little part of me that's like, oh man, this feels like where we should probably end this section, but I got a couple other things we got to talk about real quick. So for thanks for being all like erudite and crap. I wanted to give a little kind of like, you know, wink and a hat tip to the fact that Alucard can't move while he is swinging his whip. I mean, sword. He basically attacks exactly like the vampire hunters of the other games, right? Even for all of his magic and all of his nonsense and all of the other cool things he can do, when it comes to your primary weapon, your melee attack that you use for almost all of your problem solving when it comes to monsters, you have to stop and swing. You can jump, right? A lot of people do like a little hop so that they can be moving while they're attacking, but that's not always appropriate. Sometimes you need to just stop what you're doing, swing your sword. And the way they reward you for your skillful patience is in the back half of the game, you can get a sword. There's actually two of them, that you can swing while moving. And man, that just changes everything, right? So like now you are this terrifying murder machine, and that's fun. And I absolutely indulged in that. But even the whole rest of the game, I was like, every time I had to stop and swing my sword or swing my mace or do whatever, I was like, oh, they want me to still feel like these enemies are threatening, right? Even the throwaway enemies, if they can move and hurt me while they're moving, they have an advantage that I don't have. Maybe they won't defeat me, but they still have a tool in their tool belt I don't have, or I have to result to my sub weapon, or I have to, you know, go to resort to my sub weapon. I have to, you know, resort to magic or some other thing, or I have to actually use my shield. Who uses their shield? No one. Until you get shield rod, and then it's awesome. But there's something about like you can't fight and move at the same time that creates a very Castlevania sort of feeling, right? Metroid can, you know, in all the Metroid games, Samus can run and shoot her gun at the exact same time, and that gives you a different way of moving about the universe when there's enemies around. To that same kind of like combat note, this game has like really dramatic knockback, like really dramatic knockback. Like, I know Castlevania games have knockback, but holy crap, you go flying when anything touches you, regardless of the amount of damage it does. It does the same knockback animation, and I do not love it. In fact, I kind of super hate it. It's one of the only things about this game I would say I consistently find like repugnant.
Interesting. And I think that the reason why they have that kind of severe knockback is obviously in a platforming game that also generates the similar amount of fear that you were talking about.
Yeah, that's probably true, because I mean, it is in some senses a platformer, right? The only other thing that I wanted to mention is with the music and the visuals, super jazzed about the variety, right? The variety of equipment, I think, is also super cool. There's a sublayer to the stuff, which is there's so much stuff that they don't even tell you about all the stuff. And I don't think that that's a terrible thing, but it is frustrating to me as a player who likes to really, you know, squeeze all the juice out, which is there's a weapon I mentioned, the shield rod, and if you use it with different shields equipped, it has different effects. And if you use it with the Alucard shield, it's actually, that's the most powerful weapon combination in the game, right? And it's not super obvious, because you can also just wail on people with the shield rod like it's a stick, because it is a stick, right? And there's there are hidden abilities that certain weapons have, like the Alucard sword. If you do like a Street Fighter Hadouken, you know, like down to forward and hit attack, he teleports like several lengths away and then slashes back. So if you're fighting a monster that has like a long polearm weapon, you can teleport behind it and go like chop chop, and then you automatically teleport to where you were standing. And there's a bunch of different weapons that have like little special magic tricks to them. There's a bunch of little things that are just like obscured, like the a la carte armor has, if you have the sword, shield, and armor on at the same time, it gives you something absurd like a plus 30 to luck, which is really useful if you want to go find some of those secret super item drops that only certain enemies do, which is how I got the super cheaty sword, right? So like there's, for all of the stuff in this game, and there's a ton of stuff in this game, there's also like this whole sub layer of like, oh, you just have to know it's there. Or your friend has to tell you, or you have to mash buttons and figure it out. And that's
literally all of the spells in the game are not telegraphed to you in any way. Like the spells,
you can buy them. You can buy the instructions for the spells.
Okay. Because, yeah, I literally looked it up online, and I just kind of started fiddling around with it. And I'm like, wow, this is, I mean, I never used any of them because I didn't really need to. But, you know, well, I was like, this is.
You just shined a bright light on the weirdness of the spells, because most players would say, oh, you have to buy the spells. No. You have to know the button combinations. If you know the button combinations and you have enough MP, the spell works whether or not you have purchased it from the librarian, right? So there's like this whole sub layer of like, you just got to know, right?
Yeah.
And it's just, I have very conflicted feelings about that. The social aspect is cool, because it's like, oh, talk to your friends, read Nintendo Power, right? Go look around the universe you inhabit and try and find out more about the game. But part of me is like, no, just make the game tell me. You can even obscure it, but make the game tell me.
Well, I kind of, for stuff like that in general, I'm okay with it, because it's not needed to complete the game, you know? I think even your percentage like goes up to 212%, so that kind of makes the whole percentage meaningless. But no single person can give more than 100%. By definition, that is the maximum any one person can give. But all that being said is that, like, I kind of like the idea of sitting around at the playground or whatever, being like, oh yeah, man, I love playing Symphony of the Night, man. It's awesome. It's like, oh yeah, like I love getting the Alucard armor. Oh yeah, that was great. It's like, oh yeah, and then, you know, some of the spells, the what, you know, and and then just going back and being able to just like, oh, wow, yeah, there's like a whole bunch of stuff to this game that I didn't even know, you know? I kind of like that idea, just because, again, it is not required in any way, shape, or form to beat the game. If it was required to beat the game and you had to go talk to other people, like I literally was just railing to Megan earlier today because I bought Pokemon Sword and Shield for Teddy. And so I got a Machop, and I was like, oh, awesome. Cause I mean, obviously I liked the Gen 1 Pokemon, cause I was a Gen 1 Pokemon person myself. Right. So I was like, oh my God, it's a Machop, because that means he can become a Machoke and then a Machamp, and Machamps have four arms like Goro, and they're awesome. And so I was like, that's fantastic. So he became a Machoke, and I was like, great. And I kept leveling him up. I'm like, oh man, I really wonder what level he becomes a Machamp. And the answer is none. You have to trade him in order for him to become a Machamp, which made that Machoke worthless to me. I took him out back and put a bullet in his brain pan, because I am never, ever, ever going to talk to another human within the confines of that game, right? So if it was like that, I wouldn't like it. But this, it's entirely optional content, so I'm more okay with it.
That poor Machoke.
No, man, To be fair, I just put him in a sleeper hold and made him pass out. I choked him out.
what
I've done today.
My final comment before I'm ready to move on is the one thing that jumped out to me as the purest artifact of the time this game was made. Because you could put this in front of someone today and tell them, it's an indie darling, you know?
Yeah. You're going to talk about that. Okay. No, that's fair. I think I know what you're going for.
I'll be curious if we land on the same thing. The one thing that made this an artifact of its time to me is the text auto scrolls. There's no way to slow it down or choose when to advance it or go back and recover any of that information. So you just end up totally beholden to the game's pace of giving you information, which, granted, as we discussed ad nauseum, the dialogue doesn't really matter and you could totally skip all of it or not even speak that language. But the fact that dialogue just happens, you can't do anything about it, and you can't be like, wait, what did she say? You're just, that is something so of this era, because they were able to put spoken voice into the game and it never occurred to them how that would change the way the player interacted with information. So it's like, I know it's silly. It doesn't really ruin the experience because there's no information in the dialogue that you need to beat the game. But it cracks me up that is just such a late 1990s, early PS1 thing. Like that's a thing of the time, but that's it.
Yep. No, that wasn't what I was thinking of. I was stupid. No, it's okay. So this is definitely, I mean, I'd never played this game before, but like, I don't care for the name of the Dark Wizard, just because when I think,
what do you have against the Dark Priest called Shaft, which I believe is how he introduces himself. I am the Dark Priest called Shaft.
Shaft. Yeah, it's just, you know, like when I think Shaft, I think of Shaft, like the, you know, movie / police officer, right? Something. It was
a 70s movie, and then they remade it in our childhoods into the Samuel L. Jackson movie.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's the Sam Jackson movie in like the 90s-ish, right? I don't know when that came out.
Early maybe 2000s-ish?
Early 2000s. But anyways, like, I don't know why, like that to me, like, just every time it's like, oh yeah, the Dark Wizard Shaft, I just think Shaft, you know? So like that just, you know, like that takes me out of it a little bit. So when you're like, oh, we got to talk about the thing that really dates this game, I'm like, the fact that the Dark Wizard is named after like a pop culture reference to another genre that doesn't, it's completely a chronological to this one. But I mean, maybe I'm just reading too much into it.
It was far enough from the original movies and I think TV show for people to be like, you know, oh, okay, we can reuse the name Shaft. But then unfortunately it was right before the reemergence of a police officer named Shaft. Right.
Right.
So yeah, I think they were like, okay, we've created enough space. And this character is actually not unique to this game. He's been in this lore for, I think, since the beginning, but certainly going back further than this game. So yeah, I'm with you. I mean, even as a kid, every time I was like, Shaft, you damn right.
But so with all that being said, what do you think? Did it hold up?
I mean, I had to give this firm no nostalgia goggles. Like, I loved it, loved everything about it. I will absolutely replay this game again. I think you actually summed it up pretty well for me on would I be able to recommend this, which is, not only could I recommend this, but I would seek out people who are like, oh yeah, you know, Backtracker is not really my thing. And I'd be like, but have you played this one? Because this is pretty universally regarded as one of the best ever, let alone like from this era. So if you hate this one, then yes, maybe you hate all Backtrackers. But I mean, come just for the visuals, then come just for the music, then come just for the sheer volume of stuff. I mean, the whole, we didn't even talk about the Upside Down Castle, but there's a whole second game inside this game. Like, there's just, there's a lot. And I think it's all pretty much fantastic, right? Especially because the whole second castle, you can ignore like 90% of it if you want to get the, still get to the true ending. Like, it's just, it's well balanced. It's well executed. It's enjoyable. Yeah. No nostalgia goggles required.
Yeah, and I've got to completely agree with you. No nostalgia goggles required. It is just, it is a really, really great game, and it comes together incredibly elegantly. You know, I mean, like you said, like the visuals, there is just so much stuff, and even the way that they take some of the mechanics and pepper them in there, they're done in a very good way. I mean, like, for example, so often like RPG mechanics are just kind of used as makeshift Skinner boxes to put people in to make you continue playing a game you don't really like for the endorphin drip of, like, you know, just getting a little bit further. So like they'll take that and plaster it onto a bad game to make it tolerable. This takes it and makes literally parts of the game that would normally be intolerable to me, like, actually, like, it increases the flavor overall, and it does it in a you know, in a very non-manipulative way. Like, there are some very, like, malicious or even evil games out there that would, like, you know, take these and use them badly, but like this game does it in a very, very good way. I mean, and like you just said, like, you would call this a good game, right?
Yes.
Indeed. And you must always remember that the only thing necessary for evil games to triumph is for good games to do nothing.
The curtain falls. The music plays. The credits roll. Then it all fades to black. And you're left by yourself. The fanfare is gone. There's no player two there by your side to share victories won. But as you slowly progress down the hall to your bed, a few great events leak back into your head from the time that you spent traversing the land, battling evil, fighting the darkness, just sword in hand. Your memories creep in with the edge of a smile. Realize again what you've lost for a while. You're gonna think back much less on how you saved the day.